Welcome to lecture one of Epi 292 Stat 266 in spring 2021. I'm David Ragosa. Once again, I'm just providing an intro and overview here to Mike's first lecture. We also have Computing Corner, which I've done already posted on week one. For those who haven't, before we jump into this, you should take a look at the course logistics, etc., from week zero that are posted on the main page. We have audio and lecture slides that show you the course logistics and special circumstances for this year. What we have for the week one content, besides Computing Corner, where I have slides and lecture posted, are Mike's lecture from Remote Asynchronous Instruction last spring, which we jumped into by surprise. And the PDF file is 21_lect01.pdf. It reads out at 338 PDF pages, but it's not that big. The way this is constructed is multiple reveals line by line for each slide, so you just click through. And so that's the audio companion is in two parts, which is a good idea for longer lectures. About the only course logistics issue here is Mike early on in the first part speaks to the exam from 2020. And as you remember, exams in last spring, we were ungraded. It was hard to understand why we were even giving exams. So what we did was post them at the beginning as a statement about what we thought of going forward like that. This year is more traditional, although still remote distance learning instruction with its challenges, but we're doing our best. So here is week one slides. The thing to ignore early on is just the statement about when and where to submit the exams. We have different logistics and we'll, of course, write those down as the time gets closer, but it's in week zero. So here I've gone through this and there aren't any other logistical issues that I saw, but I could overlook something. So if there's any questions, just let me know. But here's the audio intro, and you can start out with Mike's slides for lecture 01. Thank you.
Hi, welcome to the audio companion for lecture one. So probably want to go open up the slide deck so you can follow along with this. Start with the introduction. So you've already, if you haven't already, you should go and check out the welcome audio that's on the landing page for the course website, and that covers a lot of the materials that is in this little introduction section in the slide deck. So you've already found the website, congratulations, and you've already found the important part, which is the week-by-week breakdown and the lecture notes and the computing corner and the readings and that kind of stuff. So let me just mention, reiterate some of the expectations for this class. The important thing is to know that this year is going to be much more self-directed. You're going to set your own pace. You can already find on the website the final exam, if you want to call it that, the take-home exam, which is due on Monday, June 1st at 5 p.m. You will send that into me, Professor Bayoki, at, sometime before 5 p.m. on Monday, Monday, June 1st, 5 p.m. But really the major takeaway for expectations is this class was designed to help you get proficient at using these methods. We're not interested in having you prove theorems. We're not interested in you being able to be all fancy. We're interested in you doing really good research, thinking carefully about how to set up a study and how to defend yourself against attacks, right? That's the kind of thing we're interested in doing in this class. And so, thinking at that level is where we want you to. We also want you to make sure that you can implement these. So we also have coding part of this class as well. I, Professor Bayoki, will be doing the lectures and introducing the concepts, and then Professor Ragosa will be doing the computation part of the class. We cannot ask questions right now. Usually this is where I pause and ask folks in the classroom what they want. So in general, questions, feel free to email us. If you're thinking more about the conceptual stuff, email me, Professor Baiocchi, or if you're thinking more computationally, email Professor Rigos. We'll also have the ability to set up with me, Professor Baiocchi. We can set up some time to talk about the concepts and that kind of stuff. So email me if you'd like to have like half an hour kind of meetups. All right, so let's go to the observational section break. This set of slides is meant to just make sure that you know that when someone says observational studies, it can get really confusing very quickly because there are so many different disciplines that have tried to engage these kinds of data, and they've come up with their own ways of thinking about and talking about how to deal with data that have been generated passively out there in the real world just watching. Rather than, I sort of do this in contrast to like a randomized trial or something like that. And I really emphasize this because there is this sort of like Tower of Babel thing going on when we try to communicate without being sort of it's really hard to be clear because we all use these terms and words slightly differently. And so in this class, we're going to take a very particular stance on what this looks like. We're going to build out of Paul Rosenbaum's view of how to do causal inference. In particular, how to do observational studies. Doesn't mean any of the other ones are awful. It means, in particular, I kind of like it personally. but his framework is to think of this as a observational studies as something pretty close to like a randomized trial that has failed a little bit, and then think about the ways that we can maybe patch up the data or craft things such that we're getting closer and closer to something that behaves like a randomized trial. There are other completely valid frameworks out there, and we will start talking about them later on, but I am very intentionally in my lectures anchored on Paul Rosenbaum's design of observational and his framework, and the reason is you need to learn one language first before you can start incorporating the other ones, right? And there are, so real benefits to having a coherent view of what how you might approach observational studies before you go off and do all the different parts. One other thing to note is I've loaded up the entire slide deck, and I do slide decks in a very peculiar way where I bring in each little increment as its own slide. That gets potentially a little confusing for folks, but it does help later on when I start doing some quote-unquote like animations. So I'm going to continue to provide the slide decks that way. It does get a little intimidating. You'll see that this slide deck that we're currently looking at has something like 340-ish slides. We're probably only going to get to about 200 of those slides today. And then you'll see that slide lecture 2 picks up in the tools section. Okay, cool. Before we get into the heart of the lecture, I'm going to go into a small bit about me, Professor Baiocchi. So I do causal inference, and I mean that sort of broadly. I do observational studies and in different sort of particular topics. So I do some work in cardiothoracic interventions, so particularly in surgery. Done some stuff about like cardiac stenting, done some stuff about like valve replacements, thinking about aortic dissections. And you'll see a study that just recently came out later on in this class where we did a instrumental variable analysis in cardiothoracic setting, surgery setting. A data set and a study that you'll be seeing a lot, I think we're even going to maybe introduce a little bit of it today, is with neonatal intensive care units. So thinking about premature babies and should we be sending them to these high-level facilities or can we get most of the benefits of the care from the lower-level facilities? And then there's another study from observational that I did just a couple years ago on criminology. So thinking through what is the impact of bail? So if you're going to set monetary restriction or monetary like bail on people, what does that do? We'll talk through that. And there's a couple different interesting features of that study that I'd like to really call out when we get to that point. But you can see I've linked to these three studies here, so you can check those out at any point you want. I also do randomized trials. So causal inference is a broad catch-all for trying to go after a causal effect, which we'll define in just a little bit. And there's two different flavors, the observational, which is what this course is about, but then I also do randomized trials. So I've done a bunch of randomized trials inside of the entry-level Stat 60 class. So the people, like undergrads, who are sort of like not super sure they want to do anything mathy, and they tend to like be very concerned about being forced often to take a statistics class. So we developed, so me and a couple other folks from education and communications, an intervention to try to help basically deal, this is like an oversimplification, but with basically kind of like imposter syndrome. And so we have been running randomized trials, I guess. So we've had like two or three about sort of like how to structure the class, and then we've had four or five that have been about this intervention to reduce the rates of anxiety and try to get people just more comfortable with taking stats. The two other large randomized trials that I've been running, actually, we're just about to start a third, are on sexual assault prevention. So most the two early randomized trials were in the slums of Nairobi, Kenya, with middle school and high school age girls, as boys as well. And now we're launching a new randomized trial at five different universities here in the United States, with a very similar sexual assault prevention program. And so they're very complicated, issues in both of these randomized trials, and I talk about them. I think I will be talking about them a bit later on in the course too, because they have to do with problems of interference. And interference is a real challenge when doing causal inference. And I just have some clean examples here from my work in randomized trials that I'll use later on. So here's some references that you can check those out. Small aside is you can call me Mike when and if we get a chance to talk person to person. If you want, you can use my last name. That's how you spell it there. It's kind of tough. It's kind of tough to say. People would definitely get intimidated. It's got three syllables. I say it as Bi-O-Key, and just giving you some phonetic way of remembering how to say it. You can call me Professor Bi-O-Key if you want, or you can feel free to call me Mike. All right, so now we're at the study design versus inference break, that slide 38. So you'll note at the bottom there, I'll try to put in links, little references to what the section we're about to enter, what it's like sort of grounded on. And this one you'll see is Don Rubin's For Objective Causal Inference Design Trumps Analysis. A lot of people just refer to this as Design Trumps Analysis. The bottom line over and over again in this class is that we want you to shift your thinking. A lot of times when people started doing causal inference, not a lot of times, back in the day, when people started doing causal inference, they sort of just immediately ported over techniques from randomized trials into observational studies, and things just didn't work. And one way to fix that is to sort of build better forms of inference. But another way is to think carefully about the data that's showing up and structuring the data better, right? So let's move into slide 39, and so forth. So I would say that, and I'm just making this up, right, is 90% of statistics classes are about inference. And inference is kind of like math. It's sort of like when you got your data, how do you compress your data in a meaningful way? How do we think about the variation that's going on? Those kinds of things. Like looking at statistics, seeing how they behave, thinking about their properties. That's great. That's a really important part of statistics. But why are people really doing inference? I'd argue that it's really useful, right? It'll get you confidence intervals, it'll get you p-values, it gets you those sort of mechanics of compressing an overwhelming set of measurements down to something that is potentially meaningful, interpretable, useful, right? So that's what inference is about. Math is also pretty cool. It's like there's something about the beauty of understanding the behaviors that give you deeper insights that are really useful and maybe portable, right? So that's why we do some of the inference. It also sort of feels hard, right? Like doing inference is, non-intuitive. And I think people would oftentimes, if they were presented a data set, they would produce maybe summary statistics. But then thinking about the behavior of those summary statistics or how to achieve them in an efficient way, those are useful, right? And it also is not something that would just be arrived at easily. So those are some of the reasons. The other reason, and this is the other ones I sort of I feel are justified. This one I don't. This last bullet point here is, I think that we focus on inference and ignore study design. Because inference is portable, Whereas study design gets you really bogged down in the details of the real world. It forces you to think about how did the data arrive, what is it that you want to accomplish, those kinds of things. Right? So we're going to be doing this like bogged down, slow thinking. We are as far away as possible from machine learning. We're not going to turn any of our thinking over to the machines. We are going to think about what are we trying to prove, who are we trying to prove it to, where did the data come from. We are in a very different world than a lot of people who call themselves data scientists. Okay. All right, so going into design, just to give you a real sense of design, I'm going to start with talking about randomization and sampling. So where do the data come from? So first thing is, like, we design randomized trials, right? Like, if you have a question, we will think about how to assign groups of people into a treatment and control. And we do that in order to try to create two groups that are very similar before the intervention happens. And we're doing that because if you're going to try to say, okay, does this treatment improve me over that control, we have to have good contrasts, right? We need to be able to say, like, well, what's the difference between those two settings? If we put you on the treatment, if we put you on the control. So we design randomized trials to try to give us really informative groups that we can compare and contrast. We also design sampling, right? Like, so if you go into the world and you want to know certain things and you can't, like, look at everybody, you try to construct a representative groups. And you can do that by thinking about what is the population, are there subsets, who's out there, who are we sort of concerned about. But then you also have to recognize that we don't know everything, right? So we often do, like, we inject some random sampling as well and make sure that we're not missing subgroups or interesting sub-features. Both of these, in a randomized control trial as well as in sampling, we use both elements of control and randomness. Right. In a randomized trial, you might do something like a match pair design, where you try to find two people who are very similar, you match them together, and then you inject randomness by saying, okay, we're going to flip a coin, and one of these two people will end up in treatment, and one will end up in control. So there's control, and that's like I think I'm using it as a verb right now. So right, we're going to exercise control over some of our observations, over our data, by restricting who can end up in the treatment, who can end up in the control. We're going to put two. We're going to find two people who could be really good contrasts. But then we're also going to exercise randomness. So that's like a key point that we'll keep coming back to. But this is like at the center of how you design things. You think about what parts you can control and diminish variation you're not interested in, and then you inject randomness in order to deal with variables or features that you're not aware of. Can't necessarily protect against. All right, so let's go through an example. So we want to study a pill, and we're going to design the study. So we're going to see if this pill, improves you, right? And we're going to have another pill, placebo, very similar. Nobody can detect the differences except for the molecules that are inside of it. Like, there really is no difference except for those, like, little active ingredients. So how do we do that? We could do a uniform randomization. We could recruit 100 people, and then we could flip a coin, a 50-50 coin, and just put people into the treatment and control based on that. That might not be great, because maybe, you know, just by flipping a coin, you could end up with, like, 60 people in the treatment and 40 people in the control group. And that's not wonderful. Maybe you want something more like 50-50. Maybe you want to restrict it. You can get more control over your randomized trial by looking at the 100 people who you recruit for it, looking in there and trying to find two people who look very similar, maybe based on their age, their height, their weight. It really depends on what intervention you're testing. So maybe this pill, let's say, it makes you taller is what we think. So you find two people who are the same age, find that they're the same gender, probably sex, actually, and think about how tall they are. You look at their parents' heights, that kind of stuff. Then you match them together, because then you flip a coin, right? That's a very different sort of setup. You could do a crossover design. Crossover designs are where, with certain kinds of interventions, you can move someone for a couple periods from a treatment and then flip them over and move them to the control. So that might be something like, in some of my studies we've run, we do a crossover design with education, where we have our intervention. So maybe we run a course here, like Stat60 runs for 10 weeks, And every week we might be able to shift someone back and forth between getting our intervention, and then the next week they don't, and then the next week they do, and then the next week they don't. And so the idea is, you might be able to, and there are problems, and we'll talk about this later on, but may, you know, you can possibly sort of see this person moving between these different levels, between seeing sometimes they're on the treatment, sometimes on the control. That's kind of a really powerful design because you're watching repeated measures through time. Another way of running a randomized trial is to have cluster randomized trials. So this would be something like, we are going to deploy an intervention and either give it to an entire school or you don't give it to an entire school. Or maybe you're doing vaccine trials and we give a vaccine to everybody in this town, but we don't give any of the vaccine to those people over there. All right, so there's some cluster, usually like geographic or social units or something like that. And that might have pluses or minuses, right? But there's, what I'm trying to say is there are different study designs, and you can think that they arise from the kind of intervention you're testing. They arise from different kinds of constraints in the real world, but they're really like centered around what kind of data would best answer your question. That is a design set of choices. Then there's the inference, right? So a t-test was built for things like a uniform randomization. T-test was originally, you know, thought of like, if we're just going to like randomly assign people uniformly, what's the behavior of the test statistic? Then there's something like a match pairs t-test where you say like, we did in fact match, let's look at the differences, let's look at the behavior of that. These are different ways of summarizing data that come from different designs, right? You could do a repeated measures model for the crossover design, and maybe you can do a generalized linear mixed model for a cluster randomized trial. But the point here is, not that I want you to know that each one of these link up, but I want you to be aware that like you've been probably taught inference, but you haven't really been taught a lot about design, to think about that these forms of summarizing data were predicated on. They were built, the math of them were built out of data coming into existence from a known data generating function, right? Like we know that the uniform, we ran a uniform randomized trial. We know that we did a match pair randomization, and that warrants, it's a technical term, it sort of, it provides a logical foundation for the models that you do later on, for the inference that you run later on. So yeah, let's talk a little bit about sampling. You want to study an election, you have different design choices. Again, you have like something like a simple random sample, you could do a stratified, you could do snowball sampling, and there are similar kinds of inference, right? You could do a t-test, inverse probability weighting, bootstrapping, generalized linear mixed model. The point is that the data come from something. Usually when we're doing a prospective study, when we're doing like a randomized trial, we're going to go out and sample, we spend a lot of time thinking about how to pick the right data. It seems there was a major breakthrough in the 80s. It seemed like it came out of nowhere, but it's not too surprising. Observational data should be thought of as being something that can be designed, right? Just because you have a million rows of data, different, a million different observations, doesn't mean that you need to use all 1 million. Doesn't mean that you get better answers from all 1 million observations. In fact, oftentimes, getting rid of some of your data, not using them, can improve your inference. You want to use the right data, right? So that was kind of a major breakthrough. And then that's what we're sort of doing, is saying like, okay, in the era of big data, the big data is kind of nice, but it's only nice because you have the availability to sift through that big data set and find the subset that's really interesting and useful and helpful for answering the kind of causal question you want. Okay. So a couple words, I'm now on like slide 84, 85, is we are going to be following sort of the philosophies that are built in statistics that are built out of randomized control trials and sampling. And this is important because these are what are known as warranted or true by construction forms of inference. A randomized trial has a permutation going on. We flip people between the treatment and control, and the form of inferences that are available there are true because we intervened in the world and we changed things. That's also true for sampling. Structural equation modeling or sort of like there are a couple different names for this, but like running a linear model and taking that linear model very seriously as a means of describing what actually happened in the world. So you write a y as your outcome, and you say equals beta naught plus beta one x, right? And then at the very end, you have that error term. That's a different set of beliefs. That's a linear model's kind of story of how data come about. That's a fiction, right? I mean, very rarely in the real world do we know, in sort of like a God's honest truth, that the outcome of interest was generated from a linear model. And even what is that error term at the end, that little epsilon? That should be like a little concerning to you. Like, what's the thing in the world that the error term is? Can you point to it? And it's really important. It's not like just like some of like silly like philosophizing here. That error term is where a lot of the debates happen, but it's also where a lot of the power of inference occurs in a structural equation model in the sort of like linear models world. That error term is what gives you inference. It's the thing that allows you to make sense of like a p value or a confidence interval. That is a different set of thing or a different philosophy about how to think about data. Is linear models like that framework useful? Oh, heck yeah. But it's also not super defensible. When you're dealing with an observational trial, or you're trying to get to your observational study, and you're trying to get good causal inference, these kinds of models open you to a huge number of lines of attack, right? Are things linear? Should we be multiplying x1 by beta 1, or should we be multiplying beta 1 by x1 squared? Should there be, you know, those kinds of things going on? So we're going to stay a bit away from the structural equation models. If you want to read and feel really bad or scared about structural equation models, there's a fantastically informative and terrifying book put out by David Friedman called Statistical Models. And that's the class that Professor Rugosa teaches. I think it's 209, which is one of the requirements here. And he goes through in very rigorous detail all the ways that you can really run a poor observational study using a linear model. Right? So if you want to be disabused, if you want to believe in this kind of framework, I'm now on slide 88. You can go to someone like Judea Pearl or go over to Econ, where they do a lot of work on these kinds of like linear kinds of models and thinking about how those behave. We will again stay away from them. I will every once in a while try to talk shit, and hopefully a friendly, not terribly disrespectful way, but you will hear me tend to point out the differences, not because I think it's horrible. I don't. But I do think that there are real points of departure, and so I'm going to use that as the boogeyman, as the beating up contrast. Cool. All right, let's talk about a little about slide 90. So we're starting to think about like inference now. So inference requires assumptions, right? There's in order to talk about the behavior of a statistic or to think about what else could have happened, you need to make either a handful of assumptions, or you need to be able to run things over and over again and then directly observe them, right? So let's just talk about this a little bit more concretely. Let's think about linear regression. So one, the most fundamental assumption is that you've got linearity and additivity, right? So if I've got an x1, it changes as x1 moves around. We're going to change in some linear way the outcome, right? So that means that we're not going to do this in an exponentiated way, something like that. The other thing is that it's going to be additive. So I've got x1, x2. I'm going to be adding those two together. I'm not going to be, you know, like doing something sort of more complicated. But that's important, right? That says something. If you're going to use linear regression, you need to know how the x's work, the covariates work, and how they relate to the outcome. Another assumption is independent errors. This is a biggie. This is like each observation condition on the x variables that we have are independent from each other, and that gets violated all the time. That's a wildly frustrating assumption. Homoscedasticity is a less important assumption, but it says something like if I get the errors wrong for this kind of person, they're roughly similar kinds of errors for those kinds of other people over there, right? So it's not like we have a really hard time predicting these people, but we have a pretty easy time predicting those people. And then normality of errors is really not a super important assumption, but you usually toss that in there in order to get a nice crisp prediction intervals, that kind of thing. And so each one of these assumptions matters, and I sort of order them roughly in like how important they are for getting really good linear regression, like getting good inference out of this. For a permutation test, there's really only one assumption, which is that you have a known assignment mechanism to treatment or control. Then you don't even need independence between people. You could between observations. You could even have interference kinds of problems. So, what is the permutation test? We'll talk about it over and over again in this class. But you can sort of roughly think of it as like a the assignment mechanism to treatment or control. And the permutation test says like let's mix people up. What would happen if we took people who got the intervention and then just relabeled them and think of them as controls? What would that do to our test statistic? So permutation test, in order for it to function, you need to make one assumption. And that's really interesting because just think about if you think about academia as like a series of arguments, if you think about like you are trying to convince someone of something and other people are trying to push back on you, a permutation test with one assumption is just easier to defend. A linear regression is super powerful. It can give you very precise answers, but there are so many different ways that people can attack you. And that's really what it boils down to at the end of the day, is one of the big contrasts. So, there are pluses and minuses. Like if you use something that's just purely a very few assumptions, very, very flexible, you tend to not get very precise answers. You tend to be giving up something in terms of like how restricted your answers are going to be, but it just becomes less assailable. So this is the kind of philosophy or the sort of driving, sort of philosophy of this course is like we're going to aim for simpler forms of inference because they're more defensible, because we're operating in a world using observational data that are super suspect. People are always going to find very creative ways to attack the data that we're doing and the analysis that we're trying to derive. So fancier methods tend to have more assumptions and then leave you open to a huge number of attacks. We in this class will be spending a lot of time trying to move you away from quote-unquote fancier methods and to pick really easier forms of inference. The work for us is going to be in the design phase. All of our work is going to be thinking about can we find the right kinds of data? Can we find the right kinds of structures for the data? Like, can we find a regression discontinuity? Can we find an instrument? If we can't, can we do a matching and then do a gamma sensitivity? Can we find very simple forms of inference? Because we don't want to, I'll get to that point in a minute. So we're going to try to use the simplest, and I'm now on slide 104 or 105, use the simplest method that gets the job done. If you want to accomplish more, go collect more data or add additional analyses. Right? One of my favorite mentors is very fond of saying, if you have to use something more complicated than a t-test, then someone messed up. You should be able to make a very compelling argument based on the data that you put in and how you crafted it. And then the form of inference, which can be very technical, should be as simple as possible. Because remember, you're trying to convince people at the end of the day, right? I usually try to get my PhD students to think about like, who are you talking to? You're trying to talk to a medical doctor. The medical doctor has had a couple courses in statistics, but is not terribly well versed. Like this is just a hypothetical. I think a t-test is going to be more familiar, more likely to be accepted. They're familiar with a randomized trial framework because that's what we teach a lot of medical doctors. If you come in with a deep learning kind of algorithm and try to make claims based on it, if the person is not credulous, if they're not willing to just accept what you're saying, then you're going to have a tough time convincing them. That's the kind of thing that's the kind of way I want you to be thinking about, like, in this course, about how we're designing trials. Is like we're aiming to help to convince people, not just do the fanciest math. So I've already invoked the idea, but and we're going to talk about it in a lot of detail, which is the idea of sensitivity analyses. If you pick a easy form of inference, then one of the major benefits is when someone attacks you on your assumption, you can now build a next level of defense. So the idea is, I don't believe this assumption. What would happen? I'm not going to give that to you. What does that do to your conclusions? And so we'll introduce in a couple classes sensitivity analysis, gamma sensitivity in particular. And it's a way of saying, okay, we understand that our data came from the real world, which is not like a randomized trial, but maybe it was kind of close. How far away from a randomized trial would things have to be before my analysis falls apart? I know that's like very high level. We'll talk about it in more detail, but there's a, if you model on a randomized trial, there's a way of thinking about observational data that talks about how far away would the data have to be in order for this to not function like a randomized trial, for my conclusions to be invalid, that kind of thing. Okay. So your analyses don't just stop at the point where someone says, "Hey, I've gotcha. I've thought of a way that your data don't work the way you think they do, and therefore everything falls apart." What you can do with a sensitivity analysis is say, "Okay, you're right. It might be that we have data that aren't perfect, but your argument isn't that there's an existence of a failure, but your failure has to be this big or bigger." Right, this is really important. So let me just try to say it again. It's like oftentimes in a random in observational studies, some critic will be very smart and very clever and say, "Hey, you forgot to deal with this issue right here, and that issue could cause a problem for you, right? It doesn't conform to all of your assumptions." So it's possible. I mean, like, so before, if you can't do a sensitivity analysis, then it becomes this like, well, does that exist or doesn't it exist? That's the kind of argument you can go for. With a sensitivity analysis, now you can quantify how much of a problem it would need to be, right? So if you say, like, here is a variable X, you forgot to deal with X, it doesn't, this violates one of your assumptions. Now we can say, if we do a sensitivity analysis, well, okay, it might be that X exists and it might cause a problem, but it would have to do a huge amount of damage. And now we can talk about it. We can actually quantify this with the gamma sensitivity. It would have to do this much damage before our analysis has to be rethought, has to be, like, it is nullified. And so that's a cool pushback. It helps you deal with creative reviewers or critics who can come up with problems. You can now push back and be like, okay, it's not just the existence of a problem. You now have to make the argument that it's a really big problem because here's how big it would need to be in order to nullify stuff. All right. So in slide 110, another option that is out there in the real world is, I pulled this directly from Wikipedia. This paper presents a breakthrough in rhetorical logic, a promising field of science of great value to those writing research proposals. It provides new and utterly convincing tools for closing embarrassing gaps in your reasoning without having to resort to brute force methods such as actually thinking about the problem in the first place. We're going to call this the Kraft-Trump theorem conjecture, which allows researchers in any field to use the technique of proof by intimidation. And just so we're clear, this came out in 2000. This has nothing to do with politics. So yes, I put this out there. We're now on slide 113 because I do worry a lot, especially even over the time that I've been here at Stanford, watching people do big data, watching the allure of like data science, that there's a lot of proof by intimidation going on, where we're starting to do things that are very fancy inside of statistics and computer science and that kind of stuff, and we're starting to not be held accountable to the people who are like applied, right? Like, so the medical doctors, we're starting to push them out of the conversation about what do our analyses need to look like, what are they concluding, that kind of stuff. I think that's really bad because we're moving away from really good science, and we're moving toward like being like a priestly caste of like I'm very smart and you should be intimidated by me and my big brain and my ability to do these computations. Like that's not what we're about, right? Like if you really are interested in good causal inference, you need to have techniques that can be understood and you can get buy-in and you can then change policy or you can have the people who are not data savvy understand why they should start changing their behaviors. I don't want to see it proved by intimidation. I don't want to see methods that you don't understand. If you can't defend all parts of it, it's not a useful argument to me. If someone can come up with a way to break it and you can't defend yourself, again, that's not good causal inference. All right, let's move on to slide 114. This is going to be an example that we come back to a lot. It's a real touchstone, and this is the neonatal intensive care unit example. So this is about premature babies. So in slide 115, the example that we'll use over and over again is about the regionalization of care. So hospitals vary in their ability to take care of preemies, of premature babies, babies that are born 37 weeks of gestational age or earlier. And it roughly sort of splits into like high-level facilities and low-level facilities. So like level one and level two NICUs, they're really not set up to deal with premature babies. But level three and above, those are facilities that are big, they're fancy, they're meant to really help. And they've got they've got like fancy machinery, incubators, like all this kind of stuff. They got doctors who are specially trained, but they tend to be very expensive, right? And so the question is, should we send all premature babies, or maybe some subset of premature babies, to these high level facilities, or can we sort of have the technology, gotten to the point where we don't have to necessarily send all of the babies to these high-level facilities, right? Maybe the level ones and level twos can actually do a pretty good job. That's the question. Or you could also reframe it as like, maybe we want to do an estimate of how many lives are saved. Maybe we are saving lives, but maybe it's not adequate given the amount of money that we have to spend or something like that. That's a kind of argument that you could go into. But that's the orienting thing. So let's go to slide 117, and we're going to go through this sort of slowly. I wish that we were here in person to show you this. But the idea is we've got two different facilities, a high-level facility and a low-level facility. On slide 118, you can see on the right-hand side, we've got the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. That is a big, high facility. On the left-hand side, you've got on slide 118, you've got a small school, like a small hospital. Actually, it is a school somewhere in, like, I think, Kentucky. Slide 119, the idea is that we are going to be looking at the babies who show up at these facilities, and then we're going to look at what comes out of those facilities. So on slide 120, you see that there's a 1% death of all the babies that show up at a low-level NICU. And then if you look at slide 121, you see 2% die at the high-level facility. And that's kind of shocking, right? I mean, like, if you don't know anything about observational studies, it's super weird that more babies die at the good facility and fewer die at the not-as-good facility. But the issue here, if you go to slide 122, is that people are assuming that the inputs are very similar, and therefore they can look at any variation in the outcome and attribute it to the treatment. But that doesn't actually make sense. If you go to slide 123, what actually happens in this case is that everybody knows those are good facilities, so they send different kinds of babies there, right? The sicker, the sort of more problematic babies tend to show up at the higher level facilities. We've sort of stacked the deck against the high level facility. And the real issue here is that one way to think about this issue is that outcome, the outcomes that you see from the low-level facility and the high-level facility are a composition. They're a composition of the effect of the facility composed with the sort of variation of the inputs, right? So if you look at the outcomes and you compare them, you're not comparing for the treatment effect, you're actually comparing for both the variation in the inputs and the variation in the treatment. And so, on slide 124, we had a ton of data. We had all babies born in hospitals for about a decade from California, Pennsylvania, and Missouri. So we just have a very large number of observations, right? Like a couple million babies, several million babies. And then we had information, ICD-9 codes. Those are medical codes, or I guess they're billing codes, actually, but they track, like, how complicated the care was for the mom and the baby. We know things about, like, how the delivery went. We know some pre-delivery stuff, like if mama had, like, gestational diabetes or something like that, we're aware of that. We also had some stuff about the socioeconomic status of the mother and baby. We know what zip code they were in, so we have, like, the milieu that they were coming from. We then also have birth and death certificates, so we know the gestational age of the baby. We know their birth weight. We know whether the baby died. So we got a lot of information, but nowhere, if you go to slide 125, is like a perfect measurement of exactly how sick the baby was when mom showed up to the facility. Right? We don't know the potential sort of probability. We don't know the probability of death. When she was deciding if she would go to a high-level or a low-level neonatal intensive care unit, to a high-level low-level NICU. So I think if you go to slide 127, what we're worried about is that we want to quantify the effect of high-level NICU on the rate of death. If we move a particular baby from a low-level facility to a high-level facility, how would that change the probability of that baby dying, right? The problem is that we're dealing with observational data, so we didn't randomize. We're not 100% sure why someone showed up in one place versus another. And there's this thing that I sort of casually refer to as sorting bias. People will also sort of call this confounding or something like that. But the idea is that people are not just showing up randomly. They really, the assignment mechanism or how people showed up, there was some intentionality. And that intentionality was like, hey, you have a very early term baby. Like, I'm going to send you to the higher level facility. Or we're aware that you may have a very complicated birth, so we've trained mom to go to that high-level facility. It's not just random. But we'll get back to that in a couple minutes. There are a bunch of different factors that sort of determine, and we'll talk about that. Here's the point that if you've ever done observational studies, you've heard about over and over again, which is that we are really, really worried about some of the variables that are causing the sorting being variables we're unaware of. So maybe we could do something like, excuse me, if I know that two babies, one baby is really small, one baby is really large, I'm not going to compare them. Excuse me. So I might look through a data set and find two babies who look identical in every single way. One went to the high-level facility, one went to the low-level facility. But if they are different in ways that we're not aware of, the fact that one went to a high-level facility may tell you how sick that baby is. Right? This comes out sometimes like confounding on indication or something like that. But the issue here is that like some of the sorting may happen on variables that the mom or the doctor that they're aware of, but we as analysts aren't.